Om Partaya Patipotitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anusantadami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini. Okay, so we are on verse 17. Sattvat sanjayate jnanam. Sattvat sanjayate jnanam. Rajaso lobha eva cha. Rajaso lobha eva cha. Pramada moha tamasaha. Pramada moha tamasaha. Bhavato jnanam eva cha. Bhavato jnanam eva cha. Okay, in verse 14 and...
Okay. It's okay. We don't have to do it.
Sattvat sanjayate jnanam rajasaha lobha evacha pramada mohau tamasaha bhavataha ajnanam evacha. Okay. So just reviewing here in verse 14 and 15, Krishna is talking about what happens to the person when they die, the person who is predominantly sattva. Their life has been predominant, their actions, the actions in their life have been predominantly ruled by sattva. Or what happens when they die, when it's been predominantly rajas. And then what about when it's been predominantly tamas? And then in 16, he again, it's reiterating all of these things, and in 16, he again says, they say that for the person who does good karma, karmanaha sukritasya, good karmas, dharmic karmas, the pala, the result of those karmas, dharmic karmas, is sattva. And sattva really means nirmalam. When you say that the pala is sattvic, it means nirmala. It doesn't have any agitation or any type of impurity involved with it. So it's really sukha. So without any type of agitation or ajnanam or darkness, nirmala means without any dirt. Mala really means dirt, so nirmala. Without any dirt, without any impurities, good karmas give that sattvika buddhi, that sattvika, that results that bring about sukha, that disposition that brings about sukha, ananda, happiness. Whereas the pola of actions which are predominantly are rajasic, rajas, those polas are dukkha. That result is dukkha. Pala means the fruit of an action, the result of an action. The result of rajasic actions are dukkha. They involve suffering. They bring about suffering. And then the result, the pala for actions which are basically tamas, is ajnanam, just slothfulness and lack of clarity, you know, ignorance. And so that's where we left off. And so now he goes on and he says, sattvat, from sattva, sanjayate jnanam. From sattva, jnanam, knowledge is born. Rajasaha, from rajas, means karmas or activities from that sattva guna. Take it like this, just from the sattva guna. jnanam is born. From the rajas, lobha. Lobha means greed. From tamas, pramada and moha, and ajnanam. He said pramada, moha, tamasaha, from tamas, bhavata. These two, pramada and moha and ajnanam. These are the results of tamas. And so remember that pramada means the carelessness around your choice of dharma or adharma. It's really carelessness, lack of care, laziness around the choice of your actions. It's pramada. It's a laziness or lack of care around dharma and adharma. Moha is delusion. So that pramada and delusion, and then just pure ajnanam. Ajnanam means here, not the ajnanam, not the mula ajnanam. Mula ajnanam. Mula ajnanam is that root ignorance of self-ignorance. Everybody suffers from mula ajnanam. This is ajnanam in reference to dharma and adharma. So there's delusion, there's indifference toward appropriate behavior, and then there's just confusion. So all of this, from pramada to moha to just pure ajnanam, absolute confusion about what is right and wrong, all of these are the effects of tamas. So here, he's just reiterating what we've already said. Okay, so let's do the next verse where he says something about the results of this. So, urtvam gacchanti sattvastaha, urtvam gacchanti sattvastaha, madhye tishtanti rajasaha, madhye tishtanti rajasaha, jaganya guna vrittastaha, jaganya guna vrittastaha, adho gacchanti tamasaha, adho gacchanti tamasaha. Says urdvam gacchanti sattva staha, madhye tishtanti rajasaha, jaganya guna vrittastaha, adha gacchanti tamasaha. He's really talking here about rebirth. Urdvam gacchanti sattva staha. When a jiva dies, you know, if they have been mainly remaining in sattvic activities in their lifetime, then when they die, urdvam gacchanti, they go up. Urdvam means up. So those whose life has been predominantly sattva, sattva means sattva, sattva, rajas, and tamas. If you say sattvastha, sattvastaha in the nominative plural, stha, this root, means to stand or to remain. Those who are remaining or standing predominantly in sattva, mean their life is predominantly sattva, they gacchanti, they go urdvam, they go up, they go to higher lokas. Madhye tishtanti rajasaha. Those who are rajas, predominantly means rajasthaha, staha, you can say rajasaha. Those who are rajasic, their life has been predominantly ruled or dominated by the rajasguna. Okay? They, madhye, they stay in the middle. I mean, those people are just reborn into this human. This madhye is the bhuloka. Madhye means the middle. So some go up, urdhva. The ones whose life have been predominantly sattvic, they'll go to heaven realms, to higher realms, where the upadhi is more, more attuned to the experience of ananda, where the upadhi itself is more capable of the experience of ananda. Upadhi means the body, mind, sense organs that you take in the higher lokas. It's more conducive to the experience of ananda, and also the situations that you find yourself in are more conducive to the experience of ananda. Those are the higher realms. We're right in the middle. This bhuloka is right in the middle. And so as you go up lokas, when we say up, it's a gradation in terms of satility. The gradation in terms of satility means that the antakarana is more, the realm is more sattvic. The realm is more sattvic means there's more expression of ananda. Your antakarana, your buddhi is more sattvic. The environment is more sattvic, and so the environment, you can kind of imagine it's more luminous. You know, when you see all these devatas, and if you even see the Christ figure and all these, they have these halos and everything, and the heaven is luminous. The heaven worlds are luminous because they're more sattvic. The mind is more sattvic, the upadhi is more sattvic. The whole realm is more conducive to the experience of sukha, the experience of ananda, and that's gradiated. The higher you go, the more sattvic the mind, the more sukha the person is capable of enjoying, just by the nature of the loka and also the nature of the antakarana and the upadhi in that loka. So that is a pala. That's considered, you know, the pala of somebody who's lived a dharmic life, whose actions have been primarily sattvic. They will gain a pala, which is the previous verse, which is sattvika, which means nirmala. It's free of any type of impurities or agitation. And so it's kind of like the clear water bucket reflecting the sun. How the sun is luminous in that water bucket, like that in these higher lokas, the mind, the upadhi, is more sattvic, and so there's more expression of ananda in that upadhi. So first he talked about, in this verse that we just passed, verse 16, for the good karmas, the pola is sattvika, is the sattvika pola. Sattvika pola means sukha. For Rajas, the pola is dukkha, because agitation. Agitation is like an agitated water bucket. The mind is agitated. It's seeking to gain something. It's ruled by lobha. Lobha means greed. It's ruled by pravritti, nivritti. Pravritti means I want this so that I can be happy. And then I become greedy, I become possessive. But greediness is interesting. You want something, and then you want to protect it for yourself. You know, you want to keep it for yourself. That's natural. That's the lobha. That's a natural result of your pravritti, your inclination to have this thing so that I can be happy. When you want this so that you can be happy, you want all of it. It's hard to share, so you become greedy. So that's the lobha. And that greediness and that possessiveness creates agitation, which creates dukkha. So Rajas and Dukkha go together, and then the pola for tamas is just confusion and ajnanam. The pola for tamas is ajnanam, means confusion. Ajnanam is no clarity in terms of your pursuits. Ignorance in reference to right and wrong, ignorance into what will actually give you the results that you're seeking. So those are the polas. Then he goes to the next verse, 17. He says, again, going further, it's knowledge that's born from sattva. Greed is born from rajas. And then he says lack of concern, pramada, and delusion, along with ajnanam, are born from tamas. So now we're starting to get this feel, you know, of what sattva, rajas, and tamas produces. Sattva produces ananda, jnanam, luminosity, lightness. You know, all of these are the results, the results of sattva. Rajas produces agitation and greed. Agitation and greed and pravritti, nivritti, aggression. That's rajas. Tamas produces confusion. So now he goes on and he says, those who live their life predominantly in sattvic life, predominantly sattvic, when they die, urdvam gachanti, they go up. Those who are predominantly rajas, they stay in the middle. Those who are predominantly sattva, means they're habituated jaganya guna vritta. Their activity, their nature is jaganya guna. It is of the lowest. Jaganya means lowest guna. The lowest guna is tamas. So the jaganya guna vritta, vritta staha, those who are basically living within that tamasic state, addha gachanti tamasaha, those tamasic ones, they go down. Addhas is down. So now to understand what this means, This Bhūloka is in the middle. The Bhūloka, this state that we are, this taking this human birth, where when you take a human birth, you are actually in a condition. This upadhi is able to accrue karma. You're accruing punya and papa by your actions, right? And they say in this birth, where you're actually accruing punya and papa, and you can also gain knowledge in this loka, this particular loka is comprised of 50% punya, 50% papa. So it's 50-50. What that means is that your karma is also 50-50, right? So it's 50-50, and so you're going to... The results of your actions, you know, are going to be manifesting in this world in terms of things that bring about pleasure and things that bring about pain. That's the Bhūloka. And so they say a person who is rajasic, basically driven by rajas, which means basically driven by pravritti and nivritti, I want this, I need this, I want this, I need this to be happy, I don't want this, I don't need this so that I can be happy. So both are only for happiness. But my happiness is projected onto the world. And then when it's projected onto the world, I'm going to be suffering all of these emotions, one of the extremes being lobha, greed, jealousy, envy, anger. Oh, anger when I don't get what I want, you know, dislike. Hatred, because people get in my way. I hate somebody who's somehow stopping me from experiencing, from achieving something that would make me happy. Hatred is brought about because somebody is a severe obstacle to my ananda. If they're not an obstacle, there's no reason to hate them. They're an obstacle. Other people who I just dislike, you know, they're just a minor obstacle, you know. Some people are just irritants, and they're less of an obstacle. But if they're an irritant, they're irritating me because somehow they're impinging upon my ananda, and my ananda is dependent upon the situation being in a certain way. That's why rajas produces so much dukkha, you know, because rajas means pravritti and nivritti. Pravritti and nivritti means that my ananda is situated out here. Otherwise, it's not a real pravritti or nivritti. I go toward this because that's really my prarabdha. I have a preference, maybe. And I have a preference to not go in this direction, but my ananda is not at stake. The rajas, the ananda is at stake. So that is this loka. But in this loka, this bhūloka, this middle loka, is where we're actually able to grow, to gain self-knowledge, to work on our mind, to do all of these things. We're in the higher lokas, except for the satya loka, but it's all more like a dream experience, where the kartritvam, the doership, is not considered to be there, but the experience is much more subtle. So there's much more experience of ananda in these upper lokas. It's only in the very top loka, though, that they say you can, and which is the most subtle, that you can also gain self-knowledge. So this loka is for all of us, you know, because all of us are predominantly motivated by the ajnanam, which causes the pravritti and the nivritti. Let me have this so I can be happy. Let me not have this so I can be happy, and all of the negative emotions that causes. It does, because it causes happy emotions too, but we don't care about those. We care about the ones that are causing pain, you know. Predominantly dukkha. You got little moments of sukha when things go your way, but otherwise it's stress and tension. So it's primarily agitation, primarily rajas. That's the middle one. Okay? And then those whose actions are primarily tamas, they go down. Now we're talking about the lower lokas. This is the hell realms, you know, where there's predominantly just, you know, suffering and ajnanam, or we're taking bodies like animal bodies or bodies that are not meant to have viveka, an animal body isn't just instinctual, basically. It is a force of nature. It's an animal body is running off of really nature. It's not so much choice. Let me do this for the sake of punya, and let me not do this. Let me not gain any papa. Let me only gain punya. Animals aren't as constrained in that way. And so when we're taking a lower birth, either the person is at those upadis where there's a state, sometimes Swamiji will say like this, a state, if we aren't talking about the hell locus, which we can also talk about, the ones that are below, you know, if we're just talking about the upadi, an animal upadi, like say if you're born, he uses the example, say you're born as a cow. A cow is subject to the same samsara that a human being is. The same ajnanam, the same total identification with the upadi, with the body, mind, sense organs, you know, the same dvaita, where I am this cow without words, you know, I am this being living in this life, that's who I am. But there's no buddhi to get me out of that. And so that's an adhoyam, yoni. That's a lower yoni. And you've taken a birth where you're just going to be exhausting karma. There's no one, there's no capacity, there's no viveka inside, you know, for that animal body to release you from samsara. So you're stuck in samsara as long as you have that body. And so they consider that body to be a lower birth because you're not able to really just enjoy the sukha of the higher births, devata births, and you also don't have the ability to gain knowledge. So Shankar even says here, he says for this jaganya guna vrittastaha, which means this lowest, the lowest guna, which is tamas, he says, mudaha, those are the mudas, people, the beings that are just completely deluded. There's no clarity of thought. They're mudas. They're adha gachanti. They go, those mudas, those ones who are driven by tamas, who have no clarity of thought, no understanding between right and wrong, adha gachanti, they go down. Adha gachanti. So the mudas go down. Adha gachanti. Pashwadishu utpadyante tamasaha. Means they are born in animal bodies, etc. Means whatever form they take in this loka, they take an animal body. That's because of a predominance of tamas. Or if they go into lower realms, that's a predominance of tamas. There's no chance to get out of it. Well, you're in it. One thing to understand about the whole Hindu cosmology is very different than in the West. In the West, or in the kind of the Christian paradigm, you have this one birth, and then say if we look at the Catholics, you have one birth, and then you are either going to be sentenced to heaven or hell, or if you're a Catholic, you have the option of purgatory. Purgatory means that you have a chance to do well, do good in that situation, and burn out your bad karmas, and then go to heaven permanently, or you just go to hell permanently. In India, they don't have any thought like that. You go to different states of experience that last as long, that are equivalent to the particular karmas that put you there. And it's not that different from here in this life. Your drishta karmas, the karmas that you do in this life, give results, right? We also say they give subtle results in the form of punya and papa, but they give immediate seeing results also. And so say if you do a negative karma, you do some sort of a papa karma, you're cruel to somebody, you're mean to somebody, whatever it is, you know, you're going to immediately reap the results of that action. You know, positive or negative, you're going to reap the results of the action. But the results don't last forever. They're not permanent. There's no such thing as a timeless result. All of the results are time-bound. And so they say even, they. So that's clear for us in this realm, that our the results of our actions are time-bound. Yeah. But here, the results of your actions in terms of punya and papa, the subtle results of your actions that will take you to heaven realms or hell realms, those are time-bound also. And so Swamiji will sometimes joke, a person has done so much punya because very much wanting to have a better next birth or to go to a heaven realm, the punya will take them to that heaven realm, but they're really only on vacation. Right? They've worked and worked and worked to accrue that those vacation months, or those vacation years. So then they accrue that vacation time, they go to Swargaloka or to whatever loka it is, they enjoy the vacation until the punya runs out, and then they take another birth, like that. It's the same, though, with papa karmas. You suffer the papa, the results of the papa, in a lower birth until that the results of those karmas wear out, and then you continue on your way. And so it's much more benign system than thinking that this is your only chance, and you make a mistake now, and that's the end of it. Or this life, why did I get this life and this other person got such a better life? You know, lives are so unequal. You know? Or I only get this one life to get everything done. There's so many things I'm not going to get to do. You know, and Hindu doesn't really think that way. These are the things that I'm doing this life. If I really have a desire to do some other things, I'll get that in another life. I can do that next life. Let me be careful to be good to everybody this life so that I can get a better opportunity next life. And that's just inborn. It's as like breathing. That's you know, being brought up in a totally held and born into a totally different mindset. And sometimes if you... In my class at school, I paint the pictures of these different mindsets. What would it be like to be born, you know, into this belief system, you know, versus this particular belief system where there's only one life and there's no reason why, there's no reason for you because there wasn't a prior life, so there's no prior karma. So there's nothing to account for the inequality in this life. And then you have to get everything done in this life to the best of your ability so that you can enjoy, you know, fulfill your desires here and also be a good enough person to get to heaven. It's your only shot. That creates a lot of pressure on the mind. A Hindu mind has a lot more relaxation because there's lots of time. Mm-hmm. Lots of time to have all of the experiences. So now he's just listed these three. So let's go to the next one. One more thing about this before, because we're going into a slightly different section. All of these gunas, whether it's sattva, rajas, or tamas, and all of the effects of the gunas, all of the polas of the gunas, all of them are time-bound, and all of them bind. The sattva guna binds in the same way as the rajas and tamas guna bind. The sattva guna will bind in this sense. Let this ananda last. Let this happy situation last. Let this happy mind last. Let me not lose this happy mind. That's binding. I want this. Don't let it go away. The rajas is binding because it causes me dukkha. The tamas is binding because I'm wallowing in ajnanam, in slothfulness. So there's just a slothful sorrow there. In dukkha, there's agitated sorrow. In sukha, there's ananda, but all of them are time-bound. Right? And so I become, prefer the sattva. And say for all of us, we're all going through sattva, rajas, and tamas. You can say, you know, when my mind is sattvic, then I'm happy. I really prefer that my mind be sattvic. I wish that my mind was always sattvic. You know, when it's rajas, I'm just unhappy, and I dread that rajas coming, actually. You know? And then tamasic, I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't get anything done. I'm just lying on the couch. I feel depressed. Nothing is happening. You know? I don't want to be like that. Why can't I always have a sattvic mind? And now I have a sattvic mind, I know that it's going to go away. So the sattva, rajas, and tamas, all are creating in their own way. They're all a bondage because they're all subject to change. Right? The gunas don't stay. For even for a mahatma, for somebody who has great antakarana shuddhi, for any human being, the gunas are not constant. They're continually changing. And so sometimes your mind is very bright. Say for Swamiji, we'll take the ultimate example. For somebody like Swamiji, the mind is sometimes very, very bright and clear. For sometimes, you know, it's restless. For sometimes it's dull and tired. You know? And so what if for Swamiji, you know, are these gunas binding? Or is he free from the gunas? What does it mean? This is what we're going into now. What does it mean to be free from these gunas? To not be bound by the gunas? Otherwise, say you're bound, you only want the sattva guna. Then your whole life you're going to be, you know, trying to do dharma, trying to do meditate, trying to do this and trying to do that, so that your mind maintains a certain condition. You want to maintain the sattvic condition. Because in the sattvic condition, I feel at peace and I feel whole and complete. And so then, you know, that's a lot of tension, and it's also impossible. So I work and work to contain and to keep the sattvic condition. So now I'm having to manage my mind all the time. And still the rajas will come in and the tamas will come in. Because that's the nature of the gunas and that's the nature of the mind. So then I become concerned about my well-being. I'm not sattvic enough. Rajas keeps coming in, tamas keeps coming in. What is it for jnani? The mind is sometimes sattvic. The mind is sometimes rajasic. The mind is sometimes tamasic. I'm neither. My being is neither sattvic, rajasic, or tamasic. My being is always exactly the same. And so I'm the self of the sattvic mind, I am the self of the rajasic mind and the self of the tamasic mind. My being remains constant. And so enjoying myself, which is not either one of the three, the mind goes through these three states of experience, and they're all fine. They're just the gunas. They're just simply the gunas. And so that's what he's going to say here. So let's read this one. Nanyan gune pyafka... Nanyan gune pyav kartaram
yada drashtanupashyati
gune bhyascha param veti madbhavam sadhigacchati says na anyam gunebhyah kartaram yada drashta anupashyati gunebhyah cha param veti madbhavam saha adhigacchati. He says yada drashta, when isn't in terms of time here. I'll explain that in a minute. But when the drashta, the seer, the drashta, anupashyati, when the drashta, the seer, anupashyati, he sees. But the anupashyati means he sees. So when the seer, means this conscious being, when he sees, anu, after knowledge. When you say like pashyati, it just means to see. Anupashyati means having gained this knowledge. After having gained this knowledge, when he sees the kartaram, when he sees the kartrutvam, myself as a karta, that this karta, na anyam gunebhya, is not different than the gunas. That there is no doership other than the gunas. All activity, all states of mind all activity that is there are just the play of sattva, rajas, and tamas. So when the jnani, when one sees this, right, then gunebhyas cha param veti, then he knows that one, param, who is beyond all of the gunas, who is free from all of the gunas. So he knows the one who is free from all of the gunas, and madbhavam saha adigachati, that one attains me, becomes me. That one is my own being. So the one who sees the one who is free from all of the gunas, that one who is param, param means beyond, free from all of the gunas, the one who knows that one, he, saha, adigachati, he gains madbhavam, my being. Okay. And what does that one see? That one sees all of the doership being nothing but a play of the gunas. Na anyam gunebhyah kartaram. Drashta anupashati. The drashta anupashati he sees, having gained knowledge, having become versed in the shastra, he sees this doership as being nothing other. Na anyah. It's not na anyam. It's nothing other than the gunas. It's not different from the gunas. And that person knows, but for that person to see that all of this kartritvam, all of this doership is nothing but the play of sattva, rajas, and tamas, to see that means to see I am not the karta. You must see I am not the karta. To see that I am not the doer, I have to see who I am. I can't just say I'm not the doer without recognizing my being as free from doership. So that's the veti. He knows the param, the one who is param, beyond, free of all of the gunas. Knowing the one who is free of all of the gunas, then he sees this kartritvam as being nothing but the play of sattva, rajas, and tamas. Right? Because the mind is, the sattva, rajas, and tamas is responsible, in fact, for the entire creation. The whole creation, if you say, is a projection of Maya, you can equally say the whole creation is a projection of sattva, rajas, and tamas, because Maya is sattva, rajas, and tamas. That is what Maya is. There's nothing outside of that. Maya is these three strands, these three gunas, the sattva, rajas, and tamas, which projects in the form of this universe, projecting as the five elements, first the five subtle elements, the five elements, space, air, fire, water, earth. If the universe projects, if the Maya projects as space, air, fire, water, earth, in the form of these five elements, and Maya is sattva, rajas, and tamas, then each one of the five elements is going to have a sattvic aspect, a rajas aspect, and a tamas aspect. And so what we say is the sattva aspect of the five elements is responsible for the sense organs and the mind, because the sense organs and the antakarana are what reflect consciousness. That's sattva. Sattva reflects consciousness. The karmendriyas and the five organs of action and the pranas, five pranas, those are rajas in terms of this upadhi, because they have to do with action, with activity, with energy. And then the tamas aspect of the five elements go through this process of panchikarana becoming fivefold to become this physical world. And so what is responsible for the form of the subtle elements, the form of the physical elements, is all from tamas. The sattva is what allows for consciousness, the reflection of consciousness. The rajas is what allows for all types of activities. Then we can go in and to look at the mind, which is predominantly by its material, sattva, the mind and sense organs. And then, as they've been saying, we can look at the mind which, when it's influenced by rajas, that sattva mind becomes more agitated. That mind, when it's influenced by tamas, it becomes more dull and slothful. The body influenced, the resolve influenced by sattva, rajas, and tamas. Your behavior influenced by the play of sattva, rajas, and tamas, right, becomes more bright, more full of tejas, more alert, more aggressive and agitated, more dull and slothful. So sattva, rajas, and tamas now becomes also looked at as a quality, you know, of these things that we experience. We can even see there'll be vegetables that are more sattvic, right? Lifestyles that are more sattvic, vegetables that are more tamasic, that type of thing. Activities that are more sattvic, activities more rajasic, activities more tamasic. Because you're just looking at these three gunas, you know, the play of these three gunas, and then also kind of superimposing them onto mental states or emotional states, which is what is being done here. So say if you're following this model that Maya projects, Maya, which is made of sattva, rajas, and tamas, and Maya projects as this whole universe in the form of the five elements, then everything that we experience here is some play of sattva, rajas, and tamas on a mental level, and the sense organs, the prana, the physical body, and the physical world. All of it is a play of sattva, rajas, and tamas. Okay, so that being so, when your mind is behaving in a particular way, first of all, the mind itself is sattva. The whole mind is sattva. Sense organs are sattva. The mind is agitated. What is that? Oh, sattva is now has a predominance of rajas. The mind is dull. Oh, that's the tamas is coming in. And so you see everything that is going on in the mind and in the sense organs and in the organs of action and in the body and in Ishvara, you know, in terms of all of the activity and the nama rupa and all of that. It's all just a play of the gunas. And so the kartritvam, the doership shows activity. I am doing this. But actually the doing itself belongs to the creation. It belongs to Ishvara. It's a play of sattva, rajas, and tamas, not of me. So now, say you recognize your being, the conscious being, myself, which is actually free of all of this activity. Then I recognize the one who is free from the play of the gunas. That one is not doing anything. There's no doership there. When I recognize that for me there's no doership, then who has the doership? The gunas. If I'm looking at it in terms of this maya, is made of only sattva, rajas, and tamas, all of this activity, we can say it's all Ishvara, you know. Where does the kartritvam lie? It's all Ishvara. Or we can say it's all of the gunas. We can say it's Maya, you know. We can say it's the jiva upadi. What is the jiva upadi made of? Sattva, rajas, and tamas. Maya. And so that's now in this text, on this chapter 14, we're reducing the entirety of our experience to these three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. So he's saying now, he's winding up after spending all this time on explaining these gunas and their qualities and whatnot. He's saying, so what? You know, now what? Now we know about all these gunas. What does that have to do with my liberation? Because this is a moksha shastra, right? So what does this have to do with moksha, with liberation? So he's now beginning. He says, you know, when the one, the drashta, the knower, knows, having been taught anupashyati, having been taught, that this doership, this kartritvam, this doership, is not different from the gunas. How does he come to that? Because now he knows the nature of the self, param, the self, which is free from, which is beyond, which is free from all of the gunas. Knowing that self, then, knowing the self is free from the gunas, beyond the gunas, then he knows that all of this activity is nothing but the play of the gunas. Once he knows that, then he attains madbhavam, my nature. That is who I am. Krishna says, that is who I am, that is who you are. That is who I am right now and at all times. I am that one who is always free of the gunas, right? The one because of whom the gunas are, the conscious being which the gunas enjoy, but which I myself don't go through any modifications at all. So since I don't go through any modifications, since my being is changeless, then who gets the kartritvam? Who gets the doership? Only the gunas get the doership. Okay? And so then he's going to go on now to describe the nature of the jnani, of the one who is beyond the gunas. Okay? So we'll do that next week. The nature of the one who knows. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
That's such a big statement to say you're free of all the gunas.
Well, there's so many different ways you can say it. You can say you're free of the whole universe, you know. You're free of any type of duality. Your being is never changes at all. Mm-hmm. So now they're just making you see that in reference to using the gunas to help you differentiate. The gunas are just becoming a tool for viveka now. Mm-hmm. It's useful, too, you know.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to ask something. I think I've asked this before in different ways. But I saw this documentary on TV about the NFL players who...
Oh, on Frontline.
Yes.
I haven't watched it.
Well, being that my son is engaged in this kind of activity, it was pretty devastating for me to see it, but also caused me to, in relation to the teaching tonight, it was a physical phenomenon that happened to the brains, to the minds of these players, and is that then just their karma that they, I mean, that seems so facile of an explanation.
You can't, that's too complicated to say, because you don't know what is the karma. And what is an abuse of free will? It's very hard to say. The prarabdha karma and the free will in any given life, you can't really tease them out, you know? And so what was the cause of that in this lifetime, if it was an abuse of free will, or did accidents happen also? But then astrologically, they'll say that the chart would show that there's a like a dangerous period, that time where a person, they'll do in India, they'll see in the chart there's these dangerous periods, and then they'll have pujas and all these things done to try to mitigate the negative karma at that particular time, you know. So you can't say one way or the other. It's not fair to say either, you know. It's like, then you see, oh, this person, this happened to this person, and that's because of their karma, that's their bad karma.
So yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't. It's too complicated to understand. So you can understand it in broad strokes, but then to become kind of a seer, you know, a prophet, somebody that kind of can see all of the ins and outs of karma as to why this particular situation happened is not right.
Well, do they do the charts on the Yani? They don't.
Oh yeah, they do Swamiji's chart all the time, bro.
But he knows he's not the gunas.
Right. But still, the sishas and the devotees want the teacher to live as long as possible. And so if they see him, for Swamiji, he's, you know, whatever. He's not going to care one way or the other, in a sense. I mean, the karma is the karma, and whatever Ishwar, it's fine, whatever it is. But the devotees are going to want to say, okay, there's some bad karma coming up for Swamiji there. We have to do all, let's do all of these pujas. And they do. They do.
Yeah. I guess that's like me wanting to avert this.
Absolutely.
This
do
bad
it, do
result
it, you
and
can.
Doing whatever I can. Yeah, and also understanding that it's not under my control.
It's under your control to some extent. Right? But not totally, for sure.
No.
Yeah.
Like when my daughter texted me, he lost the fight. I was like, happy. Yes, now he won't.
Do it anymore?
Do it anymore. But of course.
Yeah. It's hard to control him to do that, yeah. But you can pray, you know. And he, on his part, if he's doing something very dangerous, how careful will he be? You know, like, I didn't watch this football thing, but I know that I saw some advertisements about it. And some of the different equipment that they're coming out with to really help with this very dangerous sport. Some of the helmets and some of the other things that they're wearing. But then the player has to agree to wear it. Now they're starting to want to wear these things, you know.
And in those times that those kids that were then old men and got this condition, and nobody knew anything about
nobody
it.
Nobody knew it, yeah. Nobody knew.
And,
yeah.
Anyway, enough of that, but thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I played a little football in junior high school, and when I got hit in the head, then I stopped, you know, because I didn't like it.
Went into surfing.
Yeah. I thought this isn't for me.
I have two questions. They're kind of childish questions, but hey, I want to know anyway. It seems like, and I think I probably asked this before, but I don't know if you can care to comment or not, but. In my understanding, then it's a closed system, because nothing comes from nothing, and everything that already is created. So, in other words, every jiva is present in either this loka or some other loka,
or
in manifest all the time. It's all. I mean, nobody goes out of the system. There is only this. So.
The thing that is mind-boggling, the thing that makes it impossible for us to grasp is the infinite nature of it. So say, for instance, if you say that the universe itself is infinite, or duality is infinite, or the number of jivas is infinite, which is they do say, is infinite, then there's no way to get your head around that.
No, but you might think that somebody might have. I mean, there's a lot of bacterium, you know? It's a jiva.
Right, that's true.
I mean, isn't it?
Yeah. But you could say. And there's also many lokas.
Right, right.
Okay, and there's also unmanifest condition. There's also the deep sleep condition, which they also say, right? So there's all these living beings on all of these lokas and unmanifest condition. And so, yeah, the jivas are either up or they're in some form or another. And then, but it even gets more confusing than that, because also even what we know from science is that all periods of time are existing simultaneously too. And so, You know, like if you're seeing the light of a star, you're seeing that light of the star how many thousands of years later than when that light had started traveling from the star. So in terms of time, all time is happening at the same time. Something like that. Sorry. Well, I can't talk like a scientist, but the thing is, what's so interesting in the Mahabharata and the Ramayana and in the Tripura Rahasya, there's different texts where they really talk about Maya like this, that there's time within time within time. You know, like they'll have a story of some man being sent down to get a cup of water. And as he's getting the cup of water, some Maya thing opens up and he ends up living a whole lifetime with family and all of this all took place in 5 minutes and then he's back into this realm. So they have time within time within time within time. Yeah, and even they have, this is all ancient. They even talk about, okay, in this dimension, we are experiencing time. The time of this dimension. But when somebody dies and they go to a different loka, a different dimension, that their time, their experience of time is totally different. So that what may be, you know, 10 years, say you're married and you lose your partner, and you live for an additional 10 years, say. That's a long time for you. But for your partner on the other side, it could be 5 minutes because the time is totally different. The relationship is totally different. So they talk about all of this. I mean, I can't go into any kind of scientific detail. I'm just saying that this is something they talk about and that is in the tradition. And they talk about how, for us also, time is very relative. Like, if you're standing at the bus, you know, and you're in a hurry to get somewhere, it takes a long time for that bus to come. But if you're engaged in a conversation with somebody,
it comes too soon.
Yeah.
Is there going to be a point where there's more discussion of like which foods lead to which things? That's coming?
Yeah, there is.
Because otherwise,
not in this chapter, it's in 16 and 17. And then when we get to 18,
I mean, in terms of
Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, there is, not 15, but you should look ahead at 16 and 17.
Is Ayurveda based on that?
The Ayurveda, a lot of this is in Ayurveda,
The gunas.
The gunas and Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, and all of that, the five elements.
So in the unmanifest condition, these gunas are just. They're just as potentials, or
they're just an unmanifest condition.
Okay. Yeah. They're in some kind of equilibrium.
Yeah, exactly. That's the word they use, samavasta. equilibrium.
And then Ishvara, what disturbs the equilibrium so everything comes into manifestation?
Well, if you look at there's different ways of answering that. Not in yoga is totally different here, mm-hmm. But for us, it's almost like. We would ask, what causes you to wake up from a deep sleep state? Mm-hmm. And well, we'd say it's your prarabdha karma. Mm-hmm. So if we have to ask that about Ishwara, what causes Ishwara to wake up, we'd say it's the collective karma of all of the jivas causes. But that's also, that's an answer within duality. So another way you can just go, it's just the cyclical nature of the creation. You know, but then what spurs it on? You could say, well, it's the prarabdha karma, the total prarabdha karma. Mm-hmm. In the same way, what causes you to wake up? Why should you wake up?
Right. It's like in science, they've gotten to this idea of a singularity, but they haven't been able to get beyond that.
Well, they can't.
So what makes the singularity then expand into this? Universe. They can't really.
It seems to me that
they haven't gotten there yet, or maybe they can't. seems to me.
I don't know that they can't because I don't know that they can because mm-hmm. I don't know that they can get beyond duality with the tools of duality. Mm-hmm. With the tools within duality, I don't know how they can jump to the non-dual.
Right.
That's kind of an interesting dilemma.
There was a Sanskrit word used recently here, I think.
For what?
A thousand names. How the gunas that were unmanifest, something stirred them.
Oh, no, that was Vishnu stirring the pot. I mean, the ocean, the milky ocean. And the Amrita rose up.
I thought it was related to the gunas. Maybe not.
I don't think so. I think that's the story of Vishnu, you know, stirring the...
But how should we ocean. how should we see the movement? There's changeless, and it moves.
Changeless doesn't move. That's why you have to go to the dream analogy. You know, the dream analogy and to imagination, because that's when you really see the relationship between consciousness and Maya. Imagination is great. Like you can just kind of play with your mind. Imagine a meadow. Imagine the ocean. You know, imagine any type of scene. Project the imagination and withdraw it. And notice the relationship of that imagination to consciousness, to your own presence. Then you understand the satya mitya, you understand maya. Because you have a little bit of maya, limited maya. But with that limited maya, you can understand the relationship between conscious being and duality. I mean, it's amazing that we have the dream and that we have imagination to really give us a first-hand understanding of this relationship between consciousness and Maya. Very personal, intimate relationship.
And everybody has it.
Everybody has it.
Amazing. Really.
And everybody has it because that's what everything is. You know, you're a piece of the whole.
Yeah.
And the whole is Brahman plus Maya. And as a little jiva, you get to be your own Ishwara in a way. It's almost like a hologram. You get to be the Ishwara of your mind, of your imagination. And then you can get an understanding of the whole. It's really beautiful. And you can get an understanding of the mityatva of both pratibhasika and vyavahara. Pratibhasika means the dream state, the imaginal state, what you project. That's pratibhasika. So if you think of consciousness in relationship to your dream or imagination, the subjective reality, pratibhasika. And then consciousness in reference to vyavahara. After you've done the driksha viveka, to recognize that consciousness is differentiated from the vyavahara, the empirical reality, consciousness is also differentiated from subjective reality. The subjective reality doesn't have any different level of reality than vyavahara. Pratibhasika and vyavahara both are equally mitya in reference to conscious being. That's what the whole Mandukya is about.
It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. And so when you understand your own driksha, and then the driksha with the physical world, the driksha with the pratibhasika, the driksha with the vyavahara, you know, you can kind of understand the truth of it. That one's not any more real than the other, from the standpoint of the self.
Could you say that this chapter is a way to use the gunas like you would use driksha to?
Well, in a sense, it's using the gunas instead of the five elements or the objects of the panchakoshas. It's categorizing the totality of your experience into three gunas. That's what it's doing. And then you can see your experience, especially your mental experience. So this is the sattva guna, this is the rajas guna. They're only gunas. You know, myself is free of all of those states.
Is that what you commonly do, or which?
Well, as you gain knowledge, your knowledge becomes clear. That's just natural to you. When, as the ajnanam goes away, the ignorance goes away, what happens is that your being, you, are not clouded by this adhyasa, by this continual superimposition that's just an effect of self-ignorance. That's what we're doing, is just removing chunks of self-ignorance. Every prakriya,
mm-hmm.
you know, every time you're in class, there's a little bit, I mean, I would venture, that there's a little...
Hopefully.
So there's a more clarity. Swamiji sometimes says, you know, it's like with this vision, it's like as you first listen, it's like it's almost like a landscape being, you get the broad strokes, like this blue sky, one stroke, and then maybe some green background mountains and some blue lake here, just big broad strokes. And then you continue to listen, and then there's a little bit more filled in, a little bit more, another layer of clarity, and then another layer of clarity until it comes into three-dimensional focus.
Oh, it's like you, there's a tool in Photoshop and you just go more and more and large, and then in the end it's just pixels that you see it.
Yeah.
It's not made of anything.
Here, with this, you would be able to, with this creation, enlarge it into pixels so it disappears into awareness and then bring it back, you know?
Bring it back.
That's the Maya.
I want to see that painting. Mm-hmm.
And like, if I went through that process of having a rajasic desire to influence the outcome for my son, and then feeling all that anxiety about it, and then recognizing the impermanence of even feeling that way.
Yeah.
Then that's,
yeah, that's nice. Uh-huh. But what you can always do, you know, and this is where that karma yoga buddhi becomes so useful, is that you can pray for your son to Ishwara and then hand over the problem to Ishwara and then let Ishwara take care of it and accept the results as prasad.
Whatever they may be.
Yeah. But you've prayed for it and you've given the responsibility to him and you accept whatever happens as you would accept prasad. And that's helpful. I believe so much in prayer because it's one interconnected universe. Yeah. So, I've done studies also in prayer, but it's actually very helpful.
You were saying that, so this awareness of the gunas, in answer to Edward's question, it develops kind of naturally.
With Shravana.
With Shravana.
Yeah.
And particularly in this chapter, about the gunas, would it be useful to do this as a practice? Like, oh, I'm, you know, to consciously think, you know.
I think actually it is useful because we're so used to identifying with our moods. I'm happy or I'm sad or I'm this or I'm that. You know, to see it as a play of gunas, it's just one other device to give you a little distance.
It kind of cuts the Dehatma Bodhi.
It does. Yeah, it gives it does. It helps to cut it, to give the mood or the things that we're so easily identify with in terms of mental states and emotional states, to give that over to the gunas. Yeah.
Isn't that kind of a Buddhist practice? Is it in meditation, like labeling and thinking, you know, memory, heard. You know, as it flows through, in other words, labeling what it is.
I don't know that meditation, but it could be useful.
I think it goes like, this is a happy thought, this is a sad
thought.
Yeah. Yeah. Because when you do that, every time when you do that, you're objectifying it.
Right.
You're taking it away from your being and objectifying it. Yeah.
It's just
instead of saying, I am happy, this is a happy thought. You know, I am sad, no, this is a sad thought. That gives you that drikdrisha. It differentiates you from it.
I read something where Swamiji said that a vritti is just a modification of inert prakriti.
Yeah.
And that's really what, by labeling it,
Yeah, he labeled it that way. That's just another way of helping you to differentiate. But in this differentiation, you're differentiating something from you. Sometimes we're just differentiating, but we're forgetting about the self that remains as the constant. And so it's really in the recognition of your being that you can that differentiation is meaningful. So here I am, and this is what's objectified. In the objectification, it should help to recognize me, the one who's there now, freed of that adhyasa, freed of that superimposition, and then sit with me. Bring the mind just to be with me, to get to know yourself, you know, devoid of all these superimpositions. And then that becomes natural. You are always there as the self of every experience that you have. And you're not touched by any of them. And so that's the moksha, is the recognition of you are free. You are not touched by any of these experiences at all. You are always free. You're always the same. Nothing can harm you in any way. That becomes what we say, aparoksha. It becomes sakshat. Aparoksha means sakshat, immediately recognized as your being.
That can be very vivid in contemplation.
Yeah. But now the thing is, the contemplation gives you a chance to just be with that without any encumbrances. But you should do some walking meditations, walking contemplations, where you realize that when you're walking around, when you're talking to people, nothing has changed. You're as much there. Your mind can be more active, but nothing has changed for you. That's the viveka that we want. You don't want to just... Contemplation is wonderful for help giving you time to get to know yourself. Slows everything down.
Yeah.
But then what about when you're out here in the world? What's happened to you?
It's not so vivid.
But it is. That's what you have to recognize. It is as vivid, if there's no difference. But we're not used to noticing that, because the mind gets so entangled with everything out here, that you're not noticing that reality. But there comes a time when you're totally noticing that reality, that the mind in no way is covering that. It's not ever covering it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow the mind doesn't notice. It's not geared toward noticing that, not geared toward that type of viveka. The viveka is only... this is different from this is different from this. Not recognizing that all vrittis are differentiated from me. That's this kind of viveka. We only see one vritti is different from another vritti is different from another. We don't see that all of these vrittis, you know, take place, are mitya, taking place in the constancy of my being. And that's what has to come to the forefront. It's there completely. So it's not like we're bringing it to the forefront. It's already in the forefront. But my mind is not noticing it.
I actually try and do that a lot when I'm out with my dog on hikes and stuff, runs or whatever. If I could do even 1% where I'm actually noticing, that would be amazing. It's just most of the time I'm thinking about other things and get caught up in it.
Yeah, but that's a wonderful meditation to do when you're out walking with your dog. Yeah.
I'm just not very present.
But even when you're not very present, you that's not a fault. You can still be noticing when you're not very present. You can still be noticing yourself.
There comes a time when you don't need to notice yourself, because yourself is self-evident. So you don't need to notice yourself. Yourself is always noticed. So there's really no activity required. But for a while there is, because the mind is so busy, you know, that viveka isn't there. Yourself is always its own experience, and that experience never wanes at all. It doesn't matter what you're doing.
So even if you're not noticing, it's still there.
It's still there. You are still there. And there comes a time when you've kind of assimilated your knowledge enough, you've had enough time that the always being there of you is self-evident. Your mind doesn't interfere with that.
Well, the mind definitely gets, it gets more complicated because the mind, when you have a sort of a dog in the fight, you know, that in a situation where you care if it comes out one way or another and you're kind of angling for this or for that, well, then the mind is totally engaged in that and can't notice the obvious.
Yeah, but there comes a time when even though the mind's totally engaged, yourself is yourself. It's just like, they even use this example in Panchadashi. For an Ajnani, that total adhyasa with the body is there. Just, I am this person here.
Yeah.
Now, you can be totally swept up in a situation and your mind agitated and this and that. You're just totally overwhelmed by the situation. But the I am the body is always there. Not with a thought. You don't need a thought, I am the body. You are the body, right? And so that me is always there, but this me, which is always here, is totally identified with the body, right? And then is present to all of this agitation. But that sense of me, which is totally identified with the body, is always there as a given. It's a total given. You understand what I mean? Okay, and you don't have to say it. It just is a given. Now, when you gain knowledge and that dehatma buddhi, this total identification with the body, breaks down because of nididhyasana and just shravana, that all breaks down, that same me that you had taken to be the body and which was always there when you took it to be the body, now that same me is always there. You just recognize that it's free of the body. But it is still always absolutely fully present as me.
And the yoni will still have this, the dehatma buddhi. He knows he's free of it, but it still remains.
Only as mithya. Not really.
But it remains as an experience.
Yeah, that this body is me, but the me is free of the body is dominant. Mm. This body is me, the mind is me, the sense organs are me, this world is me. That's the satya mithya. But the me is free of all of this, and that is dominant for jnani, the freedom of my being. Right? This body is me, but I'm totally free of the body. Anyway, these words are only helpful if they're pointing out the reality of it to you. Otherwise, they're just silly. They have to be landing on your experience for them. Yeah. That golden thing is from the puja that Swami, you know, the Abhishekam that Swami, the Kumbh Abhishekam they did at the ashram. For that, I don't know, it was the 16th year, so I don't remember. There's so many years since the coronation of that deity, right? Mm. So it was a huge Abhishekam. And so.
Is that the very one?
No, there must have been 1,000 of these that were being done at the same time in the lecture hall.
Is there something in it?
No, but there was Ganga water and everything in it. You know, it was used for the Abhishekas. So. Okay. So some of us donate $100 or something so that we're part of that puja and then we get all, it was 500, I don't remember what it was. Uh-huh. So we got this in the mail. I got this in the mail.
They recharged the murti, basically.
That's right, that's exactly right.
It's required.
Yeah.
No, it was huge.